executive board member of the Canadian Journalism Foundation and the public editor of the Toronto Star. I'm really happy to welcome you to our last J Talk of the season, and we've saved the best for last. Arguably, I'm really delighted to welcome Margaret Sullivan to Toronto. She's really been top of my wish list for J Talks for a long time. She set the standard for public editors, the few of us that exist, and ombudsman during her tenure at the New York Times. I'm really glad we can make this happen and have Margaret come to us to talk about truth, Trump, and trying times. You can follow this conversation on CJFJTalk as our hashtag, and also you can tweet questions for the Q&A part of the evening. On behalf of the CJF, I really want to thank our JTalk series sponsors, BMO Financial Group, and our in-kind supporter, Cision. We've done 13 of these events across Canada since September, and we could not do this without the support of these really committed sponsors. So thank you to anyone who's in the room. You're going to hear more about our season later, but I really want to take this opportunity to publicly thank the CJF team that makes these events happen. They do all the heavy lifting. Natalie Turvey, President and Executive Director of CJF, Wendy Kahn, the Director of Programming, and Josh Gerfinkel, Director of Operations. And now I have the pleasure of introducing the journalists who will join Margaret in what we can expect to be a lively conversation. A Canadian news leader who really needs no introduction, right?
Oh, I don't know about that.
As you know, as most of you know, David Walmsley is editor-in-chief of the Globe and Mail, and he's also chair of the board of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. So welcome, David. Welcome, Margaret. We really look forward to your talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Kathy. It's great to be here. Thanks for coming out on a damp May evening. I was walking in, I was thinking, everyone looks miserable, and I thought, let's come and talk about Trump.
That will make us happy.
Now, Margaret Sullivan, I don't think needs much of an introduction either. The interesting aspect, though, as I do my introduction, is the very rare opportunity or the rare career path that you've taken in which you've straddled a couple of different universes, each one of which I hope keeps all of us a little bit more honest. So just as introduction, Margaret is the media columnist for the Washington Post, but before joining the Post was the New York Times public editor, and frankly a voice of common sense, which in our industry is often wanting. But before that was also the chief editor of the Buffalo News, so knows Toronto well, knows the GTA well, knows upstate New York, of course. Buffalo's her hometown paper, where she started as a summer intern. So if you actually look at that arc, it's a really great traditional career arc that allows you to then select and make the right choices in your career, which is an interesting challenge for a lot of people in our industry now, where they don't perhaps get the same consistent reach. They have stops and starts. Margaret's a graduate of Georgetown University and Northwestern University's Medill School, which I think is probably the best in North America for the journalism and the thought analysis that goes into our industry. You live in New York City. You have been a member of the Pulitzer Prize Board 2011-2012. That's a real privilege. That's a moment. You're handing out a gift based on proper metrics and on merit. And twice elected as a director of the American Society of News Editors, where you led the First Amendment Committee. The First Amendment Committee represents probably the cornerstone of what the United States represents, I would say. Free speech.
We would like to think.
You have also taught in the graduate schools of journalism at Columbia and City University of New York. Welcome, Margaret.
Thank you very much, David.
So I wanted in the conversation to allow you to begin with, perhaps, with a couple of just reflections on what you have seen through your career more broadly. And in the current day, 2019, heading into, of course, an election for the United States next year, your sense of the modern day. Doesn't have to be political, it can be, but in terms of just your broad reflection when it comes to the media scene.
So, well, first of all, thank you so much for having me here, and it's delightful for me always to be in Toronto, because as a longtime Buffalonian, I, you know, of horse would come to Toronto for the exciting life. Particularly to cut to, are any members of the band the lowest of the low here? No? Okay, that's a little disappointing, but that is a band.
I can do an intro, though,
can
for
you?
You.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, that's a band I've followed very closely in my life. Perhaps a little too closely.
And do you know why they're called that?
George W. Bush?
Yep. Yeah, he gave a quote. He said, we are not, it was an accusation, we are not something or other, we are not the lowest of the low.
But they are.
Bum, bum, bum,
there
bum.
You go. Okay. But to answer your question, I have my concerns. I have fairly big concerns these days about the state of the news media. I have big concerns about the state of how well-informed people are. One of the things that I'm the most troubled about, I'd say, is the very bad situation that local news finds itself in. That, you know, with the demise of, or the sort of precipitous decline of print advertising, that local newspapers, regional newspapers, not just in the United States, but all over the world, I think, are really suffering. And as they suffer, I think citizenship also suffers. And I would say that there's the opportunity for political corruption to flourish. So that's something that really is on my mind and concerns me a lot. I mean, I'm also very worried about the way journalists are being depicted as the bad guys, at least in some quarters. I mean, I remember as a young reporter and as a young editor, you know, feeling like this was such a noble calling. And I felt so fortunate and so proud to say that I was a journalist. And somehow, and I think Donald Trump has a lot to do with this, of course, I'm still proud to do what I do, and I think journalism is more important than ever. But somehow, the public perception of journalism has really changed in recent years, and I find that to be very, very troubling. And you know, our president has referred to the news media as the enemy of the people, and that is a very fraught phrase, and it's one that makes journalists into the enemy. And while journalists have can have and perhaps should have an adversarial role with government, we do not have an adversarial role with American citizens or with citizens. And so that's a difference that I'm seeing that is very troubling. And just the flow of misinformation and disinformation. I don't like to call it fake news because I think the phrase fake news has been turned into a weapon. And now you'll see the president and other politicians saying things that are just straight old reporting and actual accurate reporting. They will call that fake news. So I think the term has become kind of muddled and weaponized. But real misinformation, you know, these fake videos, things that have been doctored very cleverly, there's a lot out there that isn't true. And, you know, I think people are rightly confused and they need good news sources more than ever.
You paint a picture of an industry that's either fragile or vulnerable to the criticism. It always has struck me as peculiar that a president could create such a dictation to the agenda with his argument that the media is the enemy of the people and such like. There was a reference a couple of days ago that it began as a joke and it actually took off, and so we began to repeat it. But is it not the weakness of the media that we rose to the bait and gave that a legitimacy rather than dismissing that as a joke?
Well, I think that we do rise to President Trump's bait far too often. You know, I feel like we have had a tendency to let him be our de facto assignment editor. You know, whatever he thinks is the, you know, and he's the master of distraction, right? So if something comes up that maybe is troubling for him, he's sort of, look over here. Here's an insult, here's a nickname, here's a tweet. I think we've overcovered his tweets for sure. And I don't think every tweet needs to be a five alarm fire. Mm-hmm. And yes, it does bother me that we haven't, you know, shown as much. You know, we are also at a time when the news industry is looking for readership and looking for traffic, as we call it. And, you know, Donald Trump once described himself in terms of television as a ratings machine. I mean, he does compel the eye. And so it's, you know, there's no question that a headline that has Trump in it may do better than one that doesn't, you know. And so there's a kind of a weird synergy that's happening, that even though there's an oppositional force there, there's also something of an advantage in terms of compelling people's interest. And, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post have done very well in recent years. They've pulled themselves out of a really difficult financial situation into relative health. And, you know, I think the importance to people of covering this president is part of that.
I mean, some would say that the president is the same level of ADD that you see in a newsroom. That people can't spend any time. There's a natural marriage.
That's right.
For the New York Times and the Washington Post, they're distinct animals. They're very different. If I had to give a reference around the New York Times, I would say it was more comfortable in being the official opposition. Mm. Do you find that and traffic is a dangerous, full of empty calories measurement because there's no money in it.
Right.
So what is the correct response? Is it to be, where do you create a role where you're offering up an opposition and a true scrutineering role, which is, I think, what everyone would accept is the media's role with those who are elected, versus the idea that because there is either a dysfunction in the institution of Congress or there's no natural opposition in the sense that there's an automatic leader for the Democratic Party, that a newspaper, regardless of who it is, should actually fill that void?
Right. Well, you know, my boss, Marty Baron, who's going to be recognized soon by this organization, has an expression to talk about that. And, you know, he says, when Trump says or when other people say, oh, you're at war with the president, you're trying to take him down, that is not true. And Marty's response to that is, we're not at war, we're at work. I mean, we're doing the work that we do as journalists, which is to hold public figures accountable. And that is what we should be doing. And if it makes us into adversaries at times, I think that's just a function of the work we do. I mean, there's also this sense out there that, well, maybe the Washington Post and the New York Times are part of the resistance, you know, part of what's going to take Trump down. And I reject that as well. And I have my own little expression that I've developed about that, which is, it's not resistance, it's reporting, you know, and there's a difference. I don't know of anyone in the newsrooms I've worked in who is interested in a coup. We're not trying to take over, we're not trying to displace a president or anything like that. It's that our role is to hold people accountable, and there's a lot to hold accountable right now.
You've straddled both sides. We're currently working in the media, reporting on the media, assessing the media's behavior, but also previously assessing it in a way on behalf of the audience. Can one not make the argument, though, that the media has gone too far and is slavishly going after the president at the cost of other stories that are legitimate that need to be covered far beyond what is admittedly the most important office in the land?
I mean, I actually think we're still covering all of that news. It's that it may not be at the top of the homepage. It may not be on the front page, and that, you know, those are decisions that can be legitimately criticized. But I actually think that, you know, if you say, well, you're not covering something, I think often when people say that, you can often point to something, to a story that has been done. Where I think we do run into trouble with sort of perception is the blend of opinion and news, particularly in the way we receive our news now. It's in this disaggregated way, often on our phone. It's not like, oh, I'm reading the print newspaper, and now I'm going to get to the opinion pages, and I know where they are because they're in the same place every day, and that's the opinion stuff. Now back to the news. I mean, we don't receive the news that way in general as an audience. And so I think one answer to that is to sequester these things a little bit more, to say, okay, even on the homepage, opinion is over here, the rest is news, and to label things as well as we can so that when one single piece of content comes across our phone, we know what it is. I found that, you know, I write a column, so there's opinion in it. That's what a columnist does. And I would often have people emailing me and saying, it's so terrible that there's opinion in your stories. And I would think, you know, but that's sort of my job. About 2 years ago, the Washington Post started to put these little labels on particular kinds of stories. And online, so mine have the word perspective on them. And if you hover over the word perspective, it tells you, well, this is sort of an opinion piece. That's essentially what it says. And there are others that say analysis, and there's a couple other choices. And I actually thought it made a difference that when that began, I stopped getting this stuff about, please, no more opinion, because they could see that that's what it was. So I think we need to help people understand what we do a lot better.
Media literacy is a big issue, especially for the CJF. There's an awful lot of work that we do throughout the year, far beyond specific events, in which we're attempting to ensure that people who are coming to age of voting age or already are voting age, that they understand the dynamics of public life, but also in terms of the role of news organizations. And one of the challenges, it was very interesting, Dean Baquette from the New York Times said a couple of weeks ago that the most shocking discovery for him when he did a survey when he was the editor of the LA Times was that the readers looked at place lines. And
yes.
I think I know what a place line is. To me, a place line is, or a dateline is, Kabul, which means to me that I am reading a piece written in Kabul by someone, and that, I think, lends itself to an authenticity, a sense that there was a commitment and the individuals quoted. I have met as the reporter. I can stand by those quotes. But for the survey of the Los Angeles Times, it said to a majority of respondents that the place line meant that they assumed someone in Los Angeles was phoning Kabul, was phoning Vienna, was phoning
as opposed to actually being there. Right, I saw that too.
And it is jarring to the professional journalist that we are so nascent in our own understanding of our audience perception of us.
That's right.
When you've worn your reader's editor hat, what have been the big surprises, both positive and negative, that can help anyone in the room who's either involved in journalism or as a reader or interested in the industry?
So one thing that I've discovered, you know, similar to Dean's revelation about datelines, is when we talk about anonymous sources. So in journalism, we often allow people to not have their names being used. You know, we're treating them as confidential sources. And something that has come to my attention is that at least some people think that an anonymous source is anonymous even to us. That they're, you know, that we don't know who they are. Well, that is very untrue. When we use an anonymous source, it generally means that you've worked it out with the source so that you're not going to use their name. But reporters, at least in my experience, have to let an editor and perhaps a very senior editor know who this person is. So the person is absolutely known to us. We're just not going to tell the public. But when I heard that, like, you mean you think that we just picked up the phone and took this random information and put it in the paper? I mean, that's not the case. But, you know, I think that what people want from us, and I would hear this over and over as public editor at the Times, is they were not interested at all in scoop journalism or who had the story first. They wanted to know, you know, when they read it in the New York Times, it was right. It was vetted, it was right, and they really didn't care if CNN reported it a half an hour before. So that, I think, is extremely important, you know, that this question of speed that we're so invested in now, that speed kills. It's something to remember. And I also think that anonymous sources, at least in my experience, are overused. And we let people get away with it. Mm-hmm. We sort of get into this idea of, well, sure, we'll identify you as a U.S. government official, when perhaps, you know, people have a reason for wanting to supply information to a news reporter. And in my experience as a reporter, sometimes you can push back against their desire to be kept nameless. And you can say, well, blame it on the editor always. Blame it on David. You know, my editors, you know, are pushing me to get a name associated with that, and we really can't use this information unless I can use your name. And sometimes people will come around. It's sort of a crutch in a way, not to let people get away with it.
It's a great point. We're at the Globe and Mail. We have a style guide and a code of conduct, but we also have a style committee that sits and discusses. And I think the Star and Jack Nagler's here from the CBC as well, the ombuds from the CBC. And that sense of the conversation that goes through for best practices. But it is striking to me that for the Globe and Mail, we still use anonymous sources as a phrase. So the committee is meeting right now. They're discussing how we change that from anonymous sources to confidential sources.
I think it's a better word.
It's a much more precise word, isn't it?
It is. And I think it's also better understood by the reading public.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every time we use a source, the way I look at it is that it's a withdrawal from the credibility bank.
It is.
Sylvia Stead, who's our public editor, is very clear on that. She's written about that a number of times. And I think it's important as well that people understand a public editor doesn't answer into the editor-in-chief. It's a separate environment and answering separate to the newsroom.
Exactly.
The New York Times doesn't have a public editor now.
Correct.
Was that the right thing to do?
I don't think so. I think it's missed. I really do. So I was there until 2016, and my successor was Liz Spade. She was there, you know, she did some good pieces. I think she did some pieces that ruffled feathers, which is kind of the job, isn't it, Kathy? Yes. But the Times decided to end the public editor role, and the reason they gave was that, well, you know, we have social media now, and there's so much criticism coming at us on social media that actually we don't need to have an internal critic. But that is, I think, specious reasoning, because the Twitter people can do their thing, but what a public editor can do, and what I did, was I would take the controversy or the complaint and take it to Dean Becquet, or take it to a senior editor, or take it to the reporter in some cases and say, what gives here? And then be able to synthesize it and put it together for the reader. I don't think you can get anything like that in social media, and so I don't think it's a valid thing. On the other hand, I can also understand why editors don't particularly want a public editor, and I tell you this, I can't tell you it secretly because we're a room full of journalists, but I can tell you that when I was the editor in Buffalo, my publisher came to me soon after the Times had started their public editor thing, I think, and said, you know what, Margaret, wouldn't it be great for us to have an ombudsman? And I was like, no, actually, it wouldn't. I don't think we need that, Stan, because I'm out in the community, I answer my mail, I do live chats with readers, you know, I'm very responsive. And I would say that I think a paper that's the size of the Buffalo News, a regional daily, has far different needs than the New York Times, which is this sort of, perhaps can be called the paper of record, and certainly has a global presence and 1,300 or more journalists. I mean, we're on a completely different scale there, and I think that it's more important.
Yeah, I like the idea of it, I find that the role is a handrail of help. When you're either going through something that's very complex or you've made a mistake, in understanding how you made that mistake, I don't look at it from a defensive crouch. I look at it as we could do that better next time.
Right. That's very mature of you.
Thank you. Yes, I have my moments.
Yes.
At the end of our conversation, there will be questions, of course, but I just want to mention to anyone on social that you can throw a question into Margaret via Twitter at hashtag CJFTalk. So you got your chance to do that.
Good.
One of my biggest challenges is that my most sophisticated decisions as an editor are the ones you'll never see. They're the ones where I kill a story or it's not ready to go. And they're the ones where I think the public would be proudest of journalism actually working at it in its finest flight. How do we do a better job of explaining ourselves?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that exact question today. I mean, I think we have to go out of our way to explain ourselves in all kinds of different places and in all kinds of different ways. I think an editor's column can be a very useful thing. I think, as I said, live chats with readers online is frightening, but kind of useful. I did those a lot in Buffalo, and I had my managing editor sit at my side. And, you know, the questions are coming in, and you're answering them in real time. And I would absolutely be in a cold sweat at the end of the thing because, you know, you're afraid that you're going to say something insane or stupid, and it'll be held against you forever. But I think perhaps the industry as a whole needs to do a better job of marketing and advertising. I mean, I think across the board, there might even be a way to put information on our home pages or in the paper that lay out some of our standards and some of our practices. Some papers publish their ethics and style guides, but I think something even a little more basic than that that could live in a prominent place so that, you know, maybe in a question and answer format, so that people could sort of understand us a little better.
One of the things we've tried to do is something we call the backstory, where we offer up the methodology behind a story. This took this amount of time,
yes,
or this attempt to do this, or this is the reasoning behind it. And we find that in the retention numbers as we follow, people actually read that as much as they actually read the main story.
That's so interesting.
So there's the mythology of our business, and then there's the fascination with the methodology as well.
Right.
And I think that's partly why Hollywood continues to come back to journalism and spies, because they're inherently interesting to people, more interesting than perhaps we're aware.
Right, exactly right.
For you, you're dealing now with a cauldron of challenges with respect to a United States that is polarized as, I would argue, never before. Certainly it's intense.
It's bad.
The media has become weaponized to a certain degree. What do you see your role as being as that that writer and that expert, that correspondent looking in at the media?
Well, I think it's to try to, partly to try to explain, but also to be sort of, I mean, sometimes people say this about me, and it sounds a little boring, but I take it as a great compliment, that you seem like a voice of reason, that you seem like you're sane, you know, sane at an insane time. And so I think trying to, I mean, I try to write in a very clear way. I don't like fancy words. I don't like elaborate sentence structure, and I do that naturally, and I think it's right. I'm not trying to impress you with my erudition. I'm trying to be clear. So, you know, I like to acknowledge all the different sides, but I like to take a stance and try to explain my stance. So I guess, you know, laying out the issues, trying to be responsive to what's in the news right now. I mean, for example, last week, as many of you know, Julian Assange was indicted. There had been some thought that he was indicted on a simple count of sort of breaking and entering into a computer system. And that, you know, I think we can all agree that's not so good. Or helping someone do that. But last week he was indicted under this thing called the Espionage Act, which essentially has been used, you know, for 100 years to go after spies. And while we may not like Julian Assange, and we may think he's an awful guy in many ways, what happens to him is going to affect what happens to sort of regular journalists. And it's very troubling. So I wrote a piece about that and tried to take people through my reasoning that you might not like this guy and you might think he's a bad guy, but we still need to think about what the effects are going to be on journalism and on the First Amendment if this comes about the way it looks like it's going to. So I think being timely is really important, and that's part of just sort of what we do as journalists is we seize on the controversy or the development of the moment and find some piece of it that can be explained or can be sort of elucidated, and that's what I try to do.
But there is a line in terms of the Assange story where he becomes increasingly unsympathetic over time.
Absolutely.
Chelsea Manning was the one who discovered and told the truth that the U.S. military had not wanted told with respect to the two Reuters employees who were killed by a helicopter gunship. And that recording that was finally hacked and released provided some understanding as to what had happened and showed that it had been indeed a government secret,
yes,
that they didn't want out because it was an embarrassment. Assange, though, then went further and lost any sense of journalistic credentials, I think, because he released everything without assessment.
Yes.
Does that mean, which is the lesser evil, that he is the guy who should be protected because he was causing trouble and perhaps was lacking in discretion, or is it that he was someone who was attacking the very edifice of democracy and was a danger to the nation?
Mm. Well, you know, I think you can make those arguments. I guess my argument is actually a third one, which is that whatever you may think of him and what he did, there's very little question that the ordinary news gathering and news publication practices that the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Globe and Mail practice of receiving information and publishing it, you know, asking the right questions and not going too far, is being criminalized. And we can't have that criminalized. So I think when people say to me, but Assange isn't a journalist and he's a bad guy, and I say, okay, maybe so, but that doesn't change my opinion, because what happens to him is going to make so much difference to the national security reporters all across the United States and perhaps elsewhere.
But how much do national security reporters actually truly tell stories that are national security? It strikes me in the United States in particular, a lot of them are just playing in their own bathwater. There's this, I mean, honestly, if you go out onto the street here and ask anyone about national security, it's not top of the 20 issues. It's almost like there's an industry that's being created around this global bureaucratic mass employment business that Eisenhower was referencing all those years ago. The journalists had glommed onto and decided to write about this and that and my source and your source. Does it amount to anything? Does it amount to a hill of beans?
Sometimes it does. I mean, I think at the highest end, and now I'm going to go back a couple decades to say, and this doesn't address what you're saying about what it has become, but just as an example of what national security reporting can be at its most important, the Pentagon Papers in the 1970s, in which the secret history of the United States' unsavory and sometimes illegal involvements in Vietnam were brought out so that citizens could judge it. That same kind of practice of Neil Sheehan getting information from Daniel Ellsberg and taking it through and publishing it is the very kind of thing that would be harmed now. I mean, I don't disagree with you that not all national security reporting reaches anywhere near that level.
If you read Arthur Gelb's book, The City Room, in which he was the longtime serving senior editor of the New York Times, he wrestles with the morals of Pentagon Papers because it was truly a first time. And the taking over of the hotel, an entire floor of the hotel, buying these big photocopiers to see what they could do because there's no digitization. And the wrestling that he had versus the ability today of take a drive and Hong Kong or go to Russia.
Right, and this unredacted thing that Assange has done on WikiLeaks, which is not really to be at all concerned about lives at risk or anything like that, is definitely very bad. I agree. So just speaking of the Pentagon Papers and everything that happened there, one of the very frustrating... So really, it was the New York Times that broke that story, the Pentagon Papers. It was an incredibly courageous decision on the part of the man known as Punch Sulzberger. And it really was the Times' story. But when they ran into legal trouble, the Washington Post started to publish the Pentagon Papers too. So you can imagine the frustration at the New York Times very recently when this movie comes out about the Pentagon Papers and it's called The Post. Like, no, that wasn't their story. But, you know.
So if I have a... Say my niece is serving in the U.S. Marines, and the president is my niece's commander in chief, and the media are writing stories that are telling stories that my niece is not allowed to tell anyone about because she's got secret information. Do I not say the president's right? These guys are the enemy of the people.
No, you don't. You don't get to say that. In the United States, there's a syndrome now in which after 9/11 and the Patriot Act, there's been far too much information that doesn't need to be held secret and doesn't need to be classified, that's been deemed classified. And so the system is really broken. Everyone understands it, that it's broken. And the way, the sort of workaround has been that leakers, whistleblowers, whatever you wish to call them, will give information to the media, and the media, at its best, will look at it, make judgments, sometimes confer with people at the highest levels of government, or at least hear out their objections, and then publish. It's a way around a situation that shouldn't exist, which is that this, you know, massive information, amounts of information that should be accessible to ordinary citizens has been held over here.
Okay. I think national security, in a way, is a box of a very small arena, and within that, then the larger box that sits on top is the political debate. What is your perspective with respect to what I will argue argumentatively was the failure of the Eastern Seaboard media and the Western Seaboard media to recognize real Americans and not identify that Donald Trump was a very serious candidate who probably would be victorious? And how much was the inability to spot that at an early stage something that they then took out on the readers and on the president?
Took out on them?
Yeah, they were critical of themselves, and so out of guilt they decided that they had to blame the president.
I think that you can say that the American news media was at fault in not fully understanding the mood of the country. Particularly the mood of the country that's not New York City, Washington, D.C., perhaps Boston, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. So that's a lot of the country. And a lot of conservative people, a lot of people who voted for Obama but were frustrated and saw their children not having the economic advantages that they had had or were worried about that and wanted a change. So I think we can absolutely, I mean, on election night, I will tell you, I wrote a column that said that the media had performed an epic failure. So I essentially agree that it was pretty bad. However, I think there's been sort of a weird overcompensation in that now, then after that, we would go to every diner in America, you know, and try to interview Trump voters and say, now, why did you do that? And are you mean you still like him? So I think, you know, I call that the endless diner series. So I don't know. I don't know that we've really made much progress. We've just sort of swapped one out for the other. And I would also say that I think that that a lot of things happened toward the end of the campaign. The Russian interference on social media, FBI Director James Comey's handling of the reopening of the case against Hillary Clinton, among other things, that really made a difference at the end. I mean, the other weird thing was that there were all these public opinion polls. And there were things on the New York Times site and on Nate Silver's 538 site that expressed probability. And somehow I don't think we don't understand, you know, people generally don't understand probability any more than they understand anonymous sources or datelines. And so, you know, Nate Silver was saying at the end, well, there's a 70% chance that Hillary Clinton will win. And people would, you know, who were afraid of Trump winning would constantly be going, yeah, okay, Nate still says it's 70%, I guess we're okay. But the truth is, you know, there was only a 30% chance of rain when I came over here today, and you can be sure I brought an umbrella. So 30% is actually a pretty high chance that something will happen, and that is what happened. So is it the fault of public opinion polls, or is it the fault of not understanding how they're interpreted? So I think there's...
But why do the media do polls at all? I mean, they strike me as a crutch because you don't have anything original to say, so you'll make something up. Because the polls are irrelevant until the final poll.
They are.
What is the purpose of creating that expectation?
I mean, it's really a fault it's a deep fault in the news media, this sort of thing about horse race coverage. Who's in what lane? This person's in the, you know, Biden's in the sort of centrist Democrat lane. But is Pete Buttigieg coming along in the same lane? I mean, it's actually not very helpful, and it's not very good journalism. But, however, I would say, you'll hear people say, you know, what we really want is we want to know about issues. We want to know about substance. So I did a piece as public editor at the Times, and I looked at election coverage. And indeed, most of the coverage was horse race coverage. But I was also able to look at what people were actually reading, and they were not reading the boring substance stories. They were reading the horse race coverage.
They say the thing that is expected to be heard, but there's not
right. It's sort of like saying, I really like broccoli, and I'm not that interested in, you know, creme brulee.
Or I'm going to vote for Trump, but it probably isn't in polite society the thing to say in downtown New York.
So, but when you walk into the voting booth, are you going to make a different decision?
So we're going into an election year in Canada. We've got one coming up. It was interesting, actually. One of the guys, you mentioned the Russian interference. One of the members of the Russian embassy in Ottawa tried to infect the Globe and Mail with a malware virus and was unsuccessful. And there was a couple of other people we were able to spot doing that. He ultimately was kicked out of Canada for one of the tit-for-tat removals at the time of the, I can't remember the exact incident. There was an incident involving Russia where there were 20 odd expelled or 30 expelled in three or four different countries, and he was one of them. But I saw the Russian ambassador just before the guy was expelled, and I asked him about the behavior, and he laughed. He said, "You know, we're a small country. There's no way we were involved in anything in Canada or in the United States," and.
It's a guy in his pajamas on, you know, 400-pound guy. That's who
I mean, how do you think that do you think that the public looks at this as almost a fantasy, as a Hollywood movie, that there's this Russian interference?
Clearly, I don't think they care about it much.
They don't
really
care.
I don't think they care about it much. And I don't think they care about it nearly as much as they care about pocketbook issues,
right.
Healthcare, taxes, employment, trade wars. I think those things are what will matter. You know, Bill Clinton's famous expression was, in his campaign was, it's the economy, stupid. It's the economy, comma, stupid. And I think that hasn't changed so much. People really do care a lot about their own families, their own lives, and what's going to affect them. I think some people are interested in the fact that a Russian adversary is trying to mess us up, and they should be, but again, you can't tell people what to be interested in. But you can make it interesting. You know, I get frustrated about climate change, which now I think we're starting to call a climate emergency, our climate crisis, when I hear people say, well, people don't care enough about that, it's not interesting. And what I think is, it's an extremely compelling story. We better find a way to make it interesting. I can't imagine what could be much more compelling.
It becomes interesting, doesn't it, like so many topics when it affects you. So if you've lived by a riverbank for 100 years and you've never been flooded and suddenly you're flooded twice in 3 years, as we're seeing in parts of New Brunswick and in the eastern side, then you begin to think, is this climate change or are these aberrations? But then when you look out into the media scene, I'm not sure you actually find your story being captured.
Exactly.
There's still urban areas. I mean, my biggest bugaboo in my paper that keeps me awake at night is we cannot get a gardening columnist because nobody in the newsroom has a garden. It drives me insane because the readers have it,
but it's this
disconnect between who we hire, where they live, and what we should be doing. So that's my biggest concern in life.
All right, that
is the gardening column. But when it gets to climate change, it gets to issues that Trump, I posit this, that he's ahead of his time. That if you look through the arc of presidents and their communication skills, and you're going back to Roosevelt and the fireside chat, and it was a long, elongated conversation and a discursive nature around where does society move as we come out of war, then you go to, and the invention of the wireless, and you go to all the way to Reagan, who became this great communicator of television, and then you get to George W., H.W. Bush, who at the time had the perfect soundbite at 7 seconds. And then you move to the president, who's ahead perhaps by a generation of where things are going to go, with Obama being this unusual stop point where he again went back to substantial conversations without notes. Is it possible that Trump is actually simply ahead of the media in his ability to tell the story in 140 characters, where you go, that guy is actually telling me the story that I can believe There's an authenticity to what he says. And I don't need all your clever policy stories that are balanced with he said and she said. I care about what this guy feels for me.
Mm. Well, I think that he is good at making that case, and he's masterful in some ways as a communicator. But, you know, the problem is he lies all the time. And so I don't know if people think, oh, I'm really getting it straight. They're not paying attention, because what he's saying and what actually happens doesn't really have, you know, there's very little connect there. And so I don't know. I'd like to think that people care about the truth. I think they do. So, you know, he may say the elites are bad, but actually his tax policy is benefiting the highest end people. And I don't think the American public is stupid, you know, so I think mm-hmm. they will probably figure that out at some point.
But if it is a pocketbook question, the economy is rip-roaringly fantastic at the moment in the United States. Presumably he's reelected without a second question.
I don't know. I mean, I guess we'll see about that. I think that many people feel that rip-roaringness tends to benefit the people at the top of the mountain.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the way that the president deals with the media, my fear, because I think it adds the confusion, is that one day it will be discovered that Trump is a source for the media, that those anonymous sources, where a White House official said, is actually the president. We know that Trump has used the media very successfully a whole bunch of times. No publicity is bad publicity. He's quite open about that. Mm. Do you think it's possible he's a source? And if he is, do you think that creates damage for the industry by conferring confidentiality to him?
I mean, I think that if he's not a direct source, that he's got people like Kellyanne Conway or other people like that who are feeding information to the media. And, you know, I think it all has to be taken with a grain of salt. I mean, is he a direct source for the New York Times, for example? I mean, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Have you met him?
I've been in the same very large room with him, but I have not interviewed him or anything like that.
Would you like to?
Not really.
No?
No, I really, I've thought about that. I really don't want to. I really don't want to, no.
Really? I'd love to. That would be amazing.
Well.
In terms of the scene that you have, the television versus print, very different. You've talked about the conjoined twins of Trump and Fox. Mm. What is the situation today, do you think, vis-a-vis the cable channel war? Mark Burnett was a big creator and supporter of The Survivor Show, but also The Apprentice, and he worked with Jeff Zucker, who then went on to be the head of CNN News division. Is there a relationship, do you think, where CNN looks at the Trump presidency as entertainment, and Fox figures out that it's entertainment, but with authority because they can get the president?
Well, I think that CNN is one of the weird, weird stories of our time because, you know, during the campaign, they seemed to help Donald Trump an awful lot. They would actually, you know, show his empty podium before he came on to do his rallies or whatever. But then, you know, there was this whole business of Trump going after CNN, these people shouting at his rallies a certain chant, which we won't go into here because it's not very nice. And now I think CNN is seen to be and probably is more in opposition to Trump. So it's been a weird sort of, and I would also say that CNN's ratings are easily the lowest of the three big cable networks, with Fox News being number one. MSNBC, over toward the left, certainly to the left, is number two, and CNN, which kind of pitches itself as down the middle, well, I don't really think it's down the middle, it's just that it keeps moving around, as the least of the three. So it's peculiar.
And Jim Acosta for CNN had his hard pass removed, which
yes.
meant he was no longer granted access to the White House, but CNN still had 150 passes for its staff. They were hardly being censored. How much do you think it is for the reporters to get out of the way of being the news versus they want to be in the news because for broadcast so much the currency is profile? Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's a disadvantage when a correspondent becomes the news, or was that a legitimate
moment? I don't really think that the White House should get to pick who the correspondent is who covers them and say, well, we like this guy, but we don't like that guy. And Acosta, sure, he's probably a grandstander, and it's not my style. I don't like that kind of thing, but I still objected to the fact that you can't have the White House picking reporters. It just doesn't work, and that's why every news organization and every press rights organization got behind Acosta. They might not have liked his style, but they couldn't allow this other thing to happen.
Okay. We're going to come to questions in a few minutes, so if you've got them, start thinking about what you'd like to ask Margaret. When you look at the errors that get made and the mistakes that journalists do make, have you ever come across a case where it was intentional? Either as
intentional misinformation.
Yeah, that they have a real agenda and they're working to skewer the debate, either as an editor or indeed as a public editor.
I have not. I mean, I've seen journalists be sloppy. I've seen them fall prey to speed kills. I've seen poor judgment, God knows, plenty of it. But I've never seen we're out to get someone or we're going to put false information in because we have an agenda. I mean, maybe that happens on a rare basis, but I've never experienced it. I mean, the reason the New York Times created its public editor position was because they had a rogue reporter on staff, a guy named Jason Blair, who actually was fabricating and was plagiarizing and fabricating. And it was very harmful to the New York Times's reputation, and ended up taking down the editor of the paper and the managing editor. The whole thing was a disaster. So the public editor was part of the response to that. But that's extraordinarily rare.
He was a fantasist, essentially. He would say he was somewhere when he was
hiding. I think he was a really troubled guy. Not that that excuses anything, but he would do things like say he was in Honduras, but he was actually in his apartment in Brooklyn on his cell phone.
Yeah.
Doesn't really work that way.
He got the dateline wrong.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
He answered the LA Times.
Yes.
If you were to create, this is very unfair, if you were to create a media company today with all of the weaknesses and the industry challenges and the potential strengths that don't necessarily make a lot of money, what would you create? Would you create a digital platform? Would you create a combined print, broadcast, digital? How would you prevent speed from killing you?
Well, I mean, I'm a great believer in print, of course, because that's where I come from. But there's no question that we're in a digital realm here. And if I were starting something up, you would have to have digital first and digital mostly. Now, could you have a weekly or something that was print? I think there is still a great power in print. I love to see a beautiful or powerful photograph. Sometimes the story, the headline, the photograph, and it's incredibly powerful. So I wouldn't want to dispense with print altogether, but I think you'd have to be thinking completely, one of the things we're hogtied by is we come out of print, and it's very hard to change. So I think if you started digital first, and I would emphasize the watchdog role above all else. I would probably get rid of a lot of the things that we do out of habit or because we've always done it, and really push for investigative, accountability, watchdog, and let a lot of the other things fall away to be as efficient as possible.
The Washington Post has gone through a renaissance, unquestionably, with the ownership of Jeff Bezos, privately owned.
Yes.
It's not an Amazon product.
Correct.
In terms of any potential conflict, the Globe and Mail works with the Washington Post on its computer system. We take advantage of the Bezos investment in technology.
Right.
But in terms of that experience, and Marty Baron, who you referenced earlier, who has been a tremendously consistent, successful editor going back decades through to Miami and such like. What is it about the ingredient of that private billionaire ownership that has allowed the Washington Post to return to its great successes?
Well, a couple of the things that Bezos did when he bought the Washington Post, and I guess it's getting to be about 6 years ago, is, he really pushed making it a national and even global newspaper. moving out of this idea that it was really a local newspaper for Washington, but we cover national politics a lot too. No, the emphasis was going to be on the country and the world. And so that opens up a whole business model, because then you can look for subscriptions and revenue from a much larger, much larger pie. And he also, because he's a very rich guy, was able to, he said, I'm going to give you runway. In other words, here's the chance to figure it out and not be, you know, trying to cut back while you're trying to reinvent yourself. I'm going to give you runway. And so we've used, you know, I don't take any credit for it, but Marty certainly can and should, and so should our publisher, Fred Ryan, to really do the experimentation and do the nimble, you know, digital-oriented kinds of things while you have somebody's deep pockets there to support you, and you're not laying off your new people because you're trying to meet payroll. So it helped a lot.
Is there any concern that that dependence on the owner results in interference in editorial, or is it there's a clear independence?
I mean, it may happen. There certainly is a danger of it, but it has not happened at the Post. I mean, Marty, who doesn't lie, will say repeatedly and adamantly that he's never had Bezos kill a story. He's never had Bezos say, you must do this or you must do that. There really is a wall there. And I believe it because I had, when I was in Buffalo, the chairman of my newspaper, the Buffalo News, was Warren Buffett, another kind of guy with some fairly deep pockets. And, you know, I can tell you for sure that Warren Buffett, you know, he was a strong Clinton supporter, but we made our own decisions on endorsements, and he never picked up the phone. So it can be done, and it is done. And I fully believe that that Bezos hasn't done that at the Washington Post. Now, you know, does it happen elsewhere? Could it happen elsewhere? Sure.
Yeah. And just one last question. You referenced the youngsters and ensuring that they have the chance to succeed in our industry. What message do you have for the journalists coming into the business?
Well, it's really tricky because the path that I took of starting out at a regional paper and working my way up and then moving to the national is a much less common kind of thing. Those papers aren't hiring anymore to a large extent, and some of them are really threatened. What I would say is you better really want to do this work because it's not for the faint of heart, and not in any way. You better be darn good at it. You better have been doing it since college or maybe high school and be firmly committed to it. But if you are, it's a great thing because, you know, we need committed young journalists, and I actually believe there will be a role for them. We just don't know exactly what it's going to look like.
Thank you, Margaret. Let's move to questions, please. There's a standing mic at the back here. Thank you. And while you're gathering your thoughts, I will read a couple of a quick Twitter question.
Okay.
When writing an article, do you take into account how tribalism plays a role and how we as a society can become less tribal?
I wish I could do that. I mean, I'm intensely aware of how divided and tribal we are. I can tell you that my email is absolutely horrendous. It's so split between people saying, oh, thank you so much, and, you know, you're a voice of reason, and please keep doing what you're doing. Don't get, discouraged over here. And people saying, think of the harshest possible thing that you could call a woman, let's say, and put the word stupid in front of it, and know that that has been leveled at me many, many times. And not because I'm writing about anything that has to do with anything except, you know, national politics. It's the sinking to the lowest level of insult and abuse is very, very, very hard to take. I've had threats either by email or by phone that have caused me to send things to the security team at the Post because I was afraid. And, you know, our mail doesn't, and I'm in the New York office, we don't even get we can't get our mail directly. It has to go to Washington to be scanned before, you know, so there are very, very real threats to our person.
And the misogyny in particular is a very severe issue.
It is. It's really very discouraging, and it does take a toll. So, I don't know. I can't understand the way people go straight to misogyny. It doesn't make sense to me. I think that people are so angry that they want to lash out, and that's a way that they know that they can hurt you, and it does hurt.
Thank you for that. Please. Can you just mention your name, if you're with an affiliation or not, and then a question?
Sure. Is this working?
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Sebastian. I've always enjoyed your columns, so I just want to say that.
Thank you.
I had a question about climate change. You were talking about how it's a really compelling story, but often it's very hard to get readers interested in art. There's a perception that readers are bored with it. Are there examples of ways how climate change is being covered that has made the story really compelling, and what can the media kind of learn from those examples?
Yes, thank you for that. I think it doesn't really get much more important, does it? I think that when people can take, for example, extreme weather events that are happening, perhaps in your own community or in where your child lives or where your parents live or something like that, and tie that to the broader issue, I think that gets through to people. I think that informational graphics can be really, really compelling. So we have to bring our kind of best, journalistic storytelling instincts to it. And, I think a story that, I don't think I've read this, but I'd like to read it. I think there must be a whole generation of people who are wondering whether they should have children, because they don't know what kind of a world they're bringing their child into. I mean, that's a great story, right? And I think that brings it home. Maybe that's been written, I just haven't seen it. But that kind of thing that brings things to a human and immediate level, to me, that's one of the ways to do it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think you saw that, didn't you, during the nuclear disarmament campaigns in the early 70s?
That's right.
The idea of the birth rate.
Yeah.
Falling,
really want
and
to...
how do you begin to confront
exactly.
the nuclear question?
And yet.
Hi, I'm Olivia. I'm a news editor with Yahoo Canada here. You talked a bit about, I guess, demystifying the profession for members of the public. And I'm just wondering, I guess, you're doing, I guess, live talks with them, that kind of thing. And I guess I think that's really important, and we should definitely bring in the public and, explain to them what we actually do, because it's clear that a lot of people don't understand the difference between, like you were saying, opinion and news. Mm-hmm. But I guess to what extent do we draw the line there? Because, for instance, right now we have the leader of the Conservative Party of Canada talking about what the CBC should cover and what the CBC shouldn't cover. And I saw today a lot of people online sort of agreeing with him about that kind of coverage. And I don't know if I want all of Twitter in my morning news meeting.
Right.
So I guess, how do you balance that, letting them in, but also, I guess, knowing that we do this because we know what we're doing?
Yeah, well, to me, I think it's all of it's a great question, and it's troubling. But I think in a way it's all of a piece. We need to explain, part of what we need to explain is that our role is to be about accountability and sometimes to be adversarial. So in a way we're answering the question by explaining what our purpose is. And then at some point you just have to say, well, we can't spend all day explaining ourselves. And in some ways we have to kind of, put our big girl and big boy pants on and go do the job and hope that people appreciate it. And I believe they do. The Times and the Post, their subscriptions are way up. There is a whole population out there that feels very strongly that they need us. And so I take some comfort from that. But you're right, there does need to be a line and there needs to be a balance. And I don't think it's a very sharp line, so we have to kind of figure it out as we go along.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Anna Maria. My question is, what do you think about governments using public funds to save some of the local organizations?
I'm not hearing you. Could you?
Sorry, I'll take it off.
There we go.
My question is, what do you think about governments using public funds to save some of the local news organizations that you were talking about, or any other news organization that's critical for the survival of democracy?
Right. Well, you know, it's a tricky question. I don't particularly like the idea of government funding news organizations, but at the same time, somebody has to. So if some safeguards can be built into it, I mean, I haven't studied the BBC closely, but I think that it generally works there. You know, I worry about with local and regional news organizations, if you start having, you know, local philanthropists who also happen to be the powerful people in the community being the ones to fund it, that's a problem too. You know, for the longest time, for many decades, we were lucky because what was funding our journalism had nothing to do with journalism. It had to do with advertising. And that has really changed. So I think we have to consider every possible option, but there are some traps there. And it's good to think through them.
It seems to me that the press has often wanted to list the number of lies that the president has told. Mm-hmm. And that obviously gets to be a very large number. It seems that the Trump administration has changed its focus, particularly on climate change, and that they're going after the government scientists to change the focus of the actual scientific reports. I wonder if that's going to make it harder for the press to cover this in a effective way.
Because we're so used to the number of lies being told? I mean, I'm not sure what the connection
is. It seems very easy to say Trump lied on this because...
Right. It's a factual matter. You can say it's true
matter,
or false.
Right. It's not so easy to discredit a government scientist who says this is climate change is nonsense.
That's right. I mean, it's a huge challenge. And I think, again, we have to bring our best abilities to it and try to, you know, you can't force the truth down people's throats. You can present it in as compelling a way as possible. You can say this is false. You can say this is what the scientists all around the world are saying. And, you know, you can't actually force people to do it or to believe. But, you know, the planet hangs in the balance, so we better get better at it.
Exactly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Anne, and I'm a student journalist at the University of Toronto. There has been a lot of talks about local news being cut because of advertising, but what a lot of people don't talk about is local student newspapers, especially with what's been going on with the Ford cuts, the Ford's government student choice initiatives, and that's been taking a toll on newspapers, especially mine, being the news editor of a small local college newspaper. So I want to know your thoughts on that and what a lot of smaller newspapers can do, like especially college newspapers.
When their funding goes away because of sort
right.
of political
and affects,
reasons?
And it affects like, the quality of journalism
right.
and production.
I mean, I have to say that I really, really wish I had the answer to this. It's my biggest concern is that, you know, I think that the big news organizations are going to be okay. But, you know, I know that citizenship suffers, political corruption flourishes, students don't get the chances they need. So it's the biggest media problem we have. And I don't have the answers to it. I think the answers are going to have to be kind of multifaceted. It's not going to be a silver bullet. I have to say I'm not familiar enough with the sort of details of what you're talking about to really comment on it intelligently, or even half intelligently.
How much have you been cut by? What's the budget gone from to?
So our newspaper used to be
produced like weekly, and we used to have a lot of like frequent coverage, especially with what's been going on with print media. And because we do not have a lot of funds, and we have to like limit our like budgeting, we don't have the resources necessarily to do a lot of like journalism or like reporting that we would normally do. And we have been getting a lot of like we have been decreasing our readership because of that. And it's kind of sad, like, just kind of seeing the job you love, like, at school, like.
Keep at it.
Yeah.
Okay, who else? I'm not the greatest questioner in the world. There must be other questions. Come on. Anyone got anything?
Yes.
Now's your chance.
Okay. Hi, I'm Kate Allen from the Toronto Star. You mentioned at the beginning the sort of traditional approach to maintaining trust when covering politics, which is that we are not part of the resistance and we're not on anybody's side. Mm-hmm. We are neutral. But something that I hear increasingly, and I don't have, you know, actual data on this, but my impression is that it's something that younger people think, is that they don't really buy the view from nowhere, that they think it's dishonest to pretend that you don't have biases. And the reality is that we cover unconscious bias in other institutions all the time. And I'm wondering if you think that that is just wholesale wrong and we should reject it completely, or if there's elements of that that we can bring into, you know, other sort of more mainstream approaches to maintaining trust.
So on the question of kind of journalistic objectivity, right? Does it have value anymore? Does it matter? Doesn't everybody have their biases that they bring to the party, and shouldn't we just acknowledge it and then go from there? I think it's important to acknowledge your biases if you have them, but I think that impartiality is still something worth striving for. I mean, objectivity is a very fraught word, and I don't know if anybody can be fully objective. But I think when we walk into a police station or a courtroom or whatever institution it may be, we're sure hoping that those people are able to be impartial and consider our case on the merits. And I think the same thing ought to hold for journalism, that you ought to be getting an honest, you know, an honest broker. Now, I also think that this business of he said this, she said that, and we really don't know is useless. So I don't subscribe to that either. I don't think that impartiality has to mean false balance, you know, half of this and half of that, and you guys decide what you think. I really don't believe in that. I think we can bring more analysis, more intelligence to it, but I still think that we can. I mean, another way to think about impartiality, and maybe it's a more useful way to think about it, is fairness. Fairness. I mean, I don't think we can argue with that, right? That journalists ought to be fair and to come into something without their mind made up.
I agree with you. I'm a working journalist. My concern is that that's something that journalists think, but regular people who don't understand journalism that well, as we've spoken about, mm-hmm. don't actually buy that we approach anything impartially.
I know, it is worrisome, and I think that the more sort of mix of opinion and news that we have without any differentiation or any labeling or any attempt to explain it is going to continue to eat into that problem. But if you have news organizations that do nothing but that render opinions, you're not going to have the basic reporting that is the heart of what our profession is or our craft is. And I would worry about that, because that's the basis of everything good that we have. The opinion, even though I'm an opinionator now, I think that comes later.
Thanks.
Hi, my name is Marika. I work at CTV. Thank you for this talk. It's been really wonderful to listen to you.
Thank you.
I asked this question at an alumni event at Columbia a couple weeks ago, so I'm curious to hear your answer. Here in Canada, when you're covering American politics, they are obviously important to us as they directly affect
Sure.
things that happen north of your border. I think we tend to take cues on what to cover from what our American colleagues are doing, what they're focusing on, because there's a lot that either we don't have an inside look into or don't have the resources or time to send reporters across the country to cover things like an election. What, going into this next cycle, having covered President Trump, do you think was really missed? And I'm not talking about like the diner stories mm-hmm. or what you mentioned there, but what was a storyline or perhaps a facet of election coverage that you think your newsroom, other newsrooms in America missed that we should really be keeping our eyes open here so that we don't make the same mistakes, especially as we go into our own election coverage where we have similar yet more muted movements happening mm-hmm. in our country?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess this sounds a little similar to what I said before, but I actually do believe it's true, that we have to pay attention to individual people's lives and what matters to their lives, their families. So this kind of, you know, to, I guess people call it economic anxiety, right? I don't think that we captured that very well. I did this thing where in Western New York, I went around and talked to people about their media habits and their trust in the media. And that is a theme that emerged over and over. And I actually would ask people, you know, do you think the Russia investigation is important? And they'd say, you know, the people who are well-informed would say, you know, I think it's important, but it's not as important as whether my grown children are going to be able to have jobs that even bring them to the same level of standard of living that my husband and I have had our entire lives. And so I think getting really close to what matters to people's lives, healthcare is a huge issue. And maybe the, you know, what was the economy stupid, I think might now in the United States be about healthcare.
We're here right now, trade, which is
exactly
probably happen tomorrow.
Exactly.
So, okay. Yep. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Keith McNair. I'm a dual citizen, Canadian, U.S. Paying more attention to what's going on down south than I am to what's happening here. I'm sorry. My question is, I have a kind of a trifold, multi-question about...
Oh, I'm a simple girl, so...
Okay, well, I'll try to do it simply. It's, well, Fox News, what's to be done? So... And if I could break that out a wee bit, I'm interested in why you think they're the most consumed media outlet. If you think that will have an impact on the hearts and minds and capacity for analysis among a sector of the population that might matter for the future of the country, and whether, you know, whether or not their ties to the president are a bit problematic, and then what's to be done?
Well, I've written a lot about Fox News, and I do think that they veer very close right now to being kind of state TV, that they're kind of a mouthpiece for the Trump administration. Not everybody, you know, people will say, but they've got Chris Wallace, he's good. And that's true, he's good. There's a couple other people who are real news people, but overall, it thrives on revving up anger, and it does not hold itself to the same journalistic standards that we have. I mean, why is it popular? Well, first of all, I would, in a way, challenge that. Yes, it is the most popular of the three cable networks, but here's a little statistic for you. Sean Hannity has the most popular show on Fox, which is the most popular cable network. His evening show gets 3 million viewers. Well, now let's think about what else is happening in the evening on the media. CBS, NBC and ABC together every night get about 24 or 25 million viewers. So it's not as, you know, it looms a little bit larger than it actually is, I think.
That's heartening. Thank you for that.
Okay. I'm glad I could be hopeful.
We've got time for a couple more.
Hello. Sorry. Hello.
Hi.
Eric Morse. Of unknown affiliation, but probably confidential.
Anonymous. You can't be anonymous.
No, I can't be anonymous. I look too much alike myself. But I think it's hard to phrase the question that I want to phrase, but one of the things from the podium this evening that shocked me the most was the suggestion that Donald Trump might be his own confidential source. Now, we know he's played that game before in lesser theaters.
Yes.
But can you tell me honestly that there is a paper in the States that would not blow that as a story in and of itself?
Would not blow it, meaning?
That would not out it.
Tell the story.
Donald Trump told the newspaper today under an assumed name that.
We would never let that happen.
You would never?
I mean, you know, I know what you're alluding to. That when he was a real estate developer, I mean, this is so bizarre, really. He would call up sources, he would call up newspaper people or journalists and say, you know, in his Donald Trump voice, which no one else sounds like that in the world, and identify himself as John Barron or John Miller, you know, and actually try to, you know, talk about Trump and what a hit he was with the ladies. You know, I mean, it's amazing. I feel very confident that respectable news organizations would not allow the President of the United States to use an assumed name.
Okay, so we are fairly confident that an anonymous White House source is not the President.
Well, I mean, I'm drawing a distinction here between what you said, which was an assumed name.
I may have misspoken.
No. I mean, I'm not trying to pin you down. You know, I don't cover the White House, so I'm a little bit afraid to make a definitive statement here. But it's very hard for me to imagine that.
Thank you.
I would wager that he's almost certainly a source, and he's been granted confidentiality.
And called what?
A White House official said.
Okay. Well.
I would wager, and I think that's cataclysmic for the industry, because I think to your genuine puzzlement that this premise has even been thrown out is I think the Main Street test. And I think as an industry, that withdrawal of from the credibility bank every time one uses the anonymity will hemorrhage if it's discovered that the President is a source for a prominent newspaper in the United States.
Well, you can ask Marty that when you see him.
Yeah, I asked Marty whether John Barron was related to him. He said he wasn't. So.
Yeah, two R's instead of one.
Thank you. I had other grenades to throw, but I'll save them for cocktails.
Maybe I'll write a column about your question.
That's a great question. Any a good time for one more? Anyone got a final question? Otherwise, we'll please grab the mic. And we can grab the microphone for you. Thanks.
I get so sick of hearing Trump speak and of hearing the lies that he tells. Isn't there something that the media could do to mitigate the effect that he has, even though he's lying? You know, there used to be an expression that any publicity is good publicity, and he seems to thrive on that.
Right.
What could the media do to just minimize him?
Well, a couple parts to an answer here. One is we have to cover Trump because he's the president, and he, you know, what he does moves markets and could cause a war and, you know, all kinds of things. You can't sort of say, well, leave him alone. He's just the President of the United States. We have to cover him, and we have to cover him rigorously and actively. However, we don't have to cover everything that comes out of his mouth or out of his tweet fingers. For example, I wrote a column a couple days ago saying that his nicknames, his vicious, you know, insulting nicknames for his political opponents should never, ever again find their way into a headline, a tweet, a chyron at the bottom of the page, or a news alert. You know, we might need to write a story about some aspect of one of those things, but I don't think that we need to amplify that kind of thing with our brightest spotlights. And so that kind of judgment could come into play in some of the other things you're talking about too. We can bring judgment and moderation to the task.
Thank you all. Thank you, Margaret. Thanks, Margaret. Thanks for all your questions. We'll be moving to cocktails in a moment. I just wanted to close up. And in closing, there's a couple of slides I wanted to show you behind me. The first one, as we come to our end of season, it's our end of season party now. These are some of the images of the 13 JTalks that we put on in 5 cities across Canada. We're committed to telling the story of journalism in French and English in as many places as we can physically get to. And I'd echo, as the chair of the CJF, I'd echo what Kathy said earlier, and special credit to the staff, Natalie, Josh, Wendy, and the team who come in and have really made a real massive difference in the last year with respect to the range of voices that we hear, the diversity, and the challenges of the industry. So very many thanks for that. Through the summertime and as we head into the fall and a whole new scheduling, you'll see in the second slide there is clear following you can make with respect to social. Stay connected through both Twitter, Facebook, if you must.
We didn't even go there, did we?
The opportunities, we're only as good, and the ideas around the stories and who we can grab for those conversations are really down to your ideas. Who is it you want to hear from? What is it you don't understand? What are the puzzlements of our industry? How does our industry do a better job? And it's not about navel-gazing. It's not about just bringing journalists onto stage. It's also committing the audience, which I think so many of you involved in World News Day saw in that first week in May. And the final slide, if we can go to that, is basically our message. As journalism goes, so goes democracy. I'd like to thank you all for being here tonight, for supporting what the CJF does. It means the world to us. Journalists need friends, and we need support, but we also need to be challenged. And I think your commitment from being here, asking tough questions, getting to have a chance to meet and have conversations, is something that is a very special opportunity that we take very seriously in meeting our commitment to faithfully holding what the audience is telling us. So on behalf of the CJF, thank you to all of you. Thank you in particular to Margaret for this evening.
Thank
and
you.
Please join us for a drink afterwards. Thank you.